This broadcast of the PJC Media Network seeks to present wholesome, thought-provoking, and entertaining content. However, the views expressed by the hosts of PJC Media are theirs and theirs alone. They do not reflect the views of this network or its affiliates. Please utilize listener discretion.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White Show. Each week, we feature different topics concerning issues that sometimes can be difficult to talk about. These issues concern children and adults who may be autistic, have Asperger's, or have mental disorders of any kind. We will discuss law enforcement and how they interact with these persons. Now, let's start the show.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White Show. Tonight, we will be talking about suicide, the killer that you never see. We're talking about suicide in the police organization. And for the third straight year, suicides outnumber the line of duty deaths for the third straight year in 2018. And there is an organization called Blue, H-E-L-P, Help, which is a Massachusetts-based nonprofit. It's run by active and retired police officers, medical professionals, and victims' families. According to the organization, at least 151 officers took their own lives in 2018, the same number of suicide fatalities that were tracked in 2017, and 19 more than 2016. The single greatest cause of death for law enforcement officers each year is suicide. The suicide fatalities include 151 men and 8 women. The average age was 41, with an average length of service of 15 years. As for 2019, on New Year's Day, at least one officer has already reportedly died by suicide. Tonight, we're talking about suicide. And my guest tonight is Officer Reggie Barnes, who is a retired police officer. Officer Barnes, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening. How are you?
Good evening to you. And thank you for joining us in the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White Show. I know this is a bad topic for you and your brothers, your fellow police brothers, but it seems to be a situation that's going on. I don't know if a lot of us knew about it. Did you know that there were so many deaths going on? Well, I'm sure you did. But do you want to tell us about them?
Well, first of all, I want to dedicate your show tonight to not just the law enforcement officers, the firefighters, the paramedics, the EMTs, and all the first responders who actually continually to see the worst of human experience. There is a high number of fire personnel that have also commit suicide as well as EMT. In 2017, not just police officers, the number was not exaggerated, but it was very high of a combined number of 243 first responders committed suicide, more than the highest number of officers killed in the line of duty in the last 3 years. I don't think a lot of people understand that the hardship is just as hard on firefighters as it is on police officers.
I think that's got to be hard, especially with the things you see. You would have to have some kind of hard heart or something. but I don't know about the suicide portion of it, but there are a lot of deaths and a lot of different ways that people die that can kind of get to you. I often think about, since it's happened, with the young girl at 9 years old, that the three pit bull dogs tore her apart. And I cannot imagine how her father felt when he ran out there to save his daughter, and he said he tried to give her mouth to mouth. How can you do that? I mean, and for the police officers to see her body had to be torn. It had to be torn, because I guess a week or two later, this young lady's car had been attacked by pit bulls. And they had teeth marks all in her hood. They had pulled her front fender off because they were trying to get at a cat. Now, that's some serious stuff. If you got all, she had almost 50 holes in the top of her hood, her car hood. And I'm telling you, they had messed up her grill and her fender. So that's the kind of animal that is. But for a human being, you know, you shred the, I don't know. I would hate to see anything like that. And you guys have to deal with that. Well, maybe not now for you, but on a daily basis. I mean, they're finding bodies all over the place, and some of them are decomposing. And I've always heard that's a smell that you will never, ever forget. So I don't know. Have you ever smelled a decomposing body?
Oh, yeah, many times. I mean, my units that I had to work in, we had to go to the morgue often. So we had to identify bodies, and also we had to respond to scenes like that, too. It takes a special person, first of all, to become a police officer. It's a choice job. It's not a job where that you are forced to do. You have to have a certain stamina to learn to deal with certain issues. But I think the common denominator to all of this is we're all human. And I think that the mental stages of our life changes as we endure more of these incidents as we grow into our career. So either it hardens you or it breaks you. And I think the biggest problem that I find in the deaths of police officers and firefighters, the suicide issue is greater than people want to address. It's like the elephant in the room. People do not want to admit that it's a mental health issue at some point in time in your career. And they don't want to address it that way.
Well, and it's possible that the officers don't want it to be known that they are, that whatever, you know, is going on with them. Because I read about a first responder in New York, and he said he smelled the flesh when it was burning, and he just, every night he went to sleep, he could just smell it in his sleep, he said. And that went on for a while. He just said he, you know, thought about suicide, but for whatever reason, he didn't do it. So that's kind of a hard job. And I feel for the people that have to carry it out. And well, some of them do get hard, though. But they do get overly, you know what I'm saying? They kind of, you know, I'm the boss and you got to do what I say. Get out of the car. You know, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Were you that kind of officer, Officer Barnes?
No, well, the type of officer that I would like to think that I was I like to be able to have the track record of treating people the way I wanted to be treated.
Okay.
That's the way I would go out. And, you know, there's something that I guess I've never mentioned on your show that I think I should mention tonight. What kept me focused throughout my whole career was God.
Okay.
God kept me in a direction where I feel that as I've been retired now 17 years, and I'm actually kind of realizing that my job was not just a chosen profession. I think it was a calling, a mission for me to do the things that I did and been able to survive all these years from all the incidents and hardships and tragedies that I've went through. I don't know if I mentioned to your audience that I've been shot up several times. I've been stabbed a few. I've been in several different gun battles. I've saved so many lives of different origins from rapes, from homicides, from there's so many variations in my line of work that I'm blessed that I'm still here. And before we leave your show tonight, I want to share a personal story of my road that also was headed toward decision of depression, to where that what I've learned that PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, is a mental illness that we encounter or inherit throughout our career. When I came from the military, I had some form of it, didn't know what I had. And sometimes we, as persons, are in denial, thinking that, okay, maybe this is not me. I see somebody else with a problem, but maybe that's not my problem. We can
so
go
were you actually into combat?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And also combat and as a police officer.
Yeah.
A police officer's job is not necessarily a bed of roses. It's not like you go to your office every day. You sit down at a desk, you have a normal job where that you know that this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to run some programs, or I'm going to research some projects. Every day that you get up and strap on a gun to go look for trouble, there's no 2 days alike. I can guarantee you that. And there's no such thing as a routine traffic stop. All traffic stops have some type of expectance of the unexpected.
So that's what all the officers, that's the same way they feel when they encounter people at a traffic stop? Is that the way they feel? Is that what you're saying?
No, I can't speak on the way they feel. I can only speak on the way they're told to be trained.
Okay.
The training is that, you know, you have to approach a vehicle as if it's a vehicle subject to whatever you're going to encounter, engage. What people don't understand is that when you stop a car, say for instance, a speeding car, you really don't know why you're stopping the car from where the origin is coming from. I don't know if it's leaving a crime scene. I don't know if they are going to a crime scene. I don't know if they're running from somebody. I mean, what do you know about the car until you stop them, right?
Yeah,
so
but you probably have run the plates and, you know,
Well, it depends on the era and the time that you came on. When we came on, when I came on, we didn't have the ability to run a plate before you stop and go investigate the car. That wasn't available back in the early 70s. It didn't come out to the middle or late 70s when you had the ability to use a computer. But then remember, too, everything was new when you started using technology.
And then weren't you on a motor scooter?
No, it was a motorcycle. It was a Harley-Davidson motorcycle.
Okay.
Let me clarify that. There is a scooter, a police scooter, that they do use, and normally that's used in a community policing, like around the schools and different events. And then there's a police Harley-Davidson motorcycle. That's what I rode. I rode that with what they call we were a strike force that what we handled were presidential escorts and dignitary escorts and things that were necessary to handle prime events. So that's the difference between those two motorcycles.
Okay, a motorcycle. I thought they were all motorcycles until someone mentioned that they might have been motor scooters. Anyway.
Well, that's the motorcycle that pulls you over on the freeway, not a scooter. The one that has the lights and the sirens on it.
Can you go on the freeway in a scooter?
You can go on a freeway with the scooter because it has the ability to go to the posted speed limit, but it's not a vehicle that's set up to stop vehicles. There's a difference.
I know, because I think a vehicle will probably outrun a scooter.
Well, you're
maybe
not supposed to chase anybody with that anyway.
Oh, okay.
That's just a device or a cycle to go to and from one location to another if you're using the freeway.
Okay. So,
that's the newer ones, not the older ones. The newer ones can do that because they're more beefed up.
Okay. Well, I was reading that there were four states who had the highest number of officer suicides: California, Florida, New York, and Texas.
Mm-hmm.
They had the highest number of officer suicides, and they said that each state reported at least 10 fatalities in 2018. So,
well, 159 were male and 8 were female.
Yeah, that's kind of serious.
But that's the numbers that are reported. I don't know if I mentioned.
Well, they say that the federal government does not mandate the reporting.
No, they don't.
Officer suicides.
No, they only mandate reporting of officers killed in the line of duty.
Right.
I was an honor guard member for over 20-some years, so
explain.
We handled burials of police officers, and a lot of burials of police officers were not necessarily officers killed in the line of duty. A lot of the deaths of some police officers were undisclosed. Families did not share that information, and this more than the numbers that are reported of how officers have died. And a lot of times the reason why it's not reported is because of shame. It's because of embarrassment. It's because of, I guess, I want to say, I don't want to say it's a cowardly act, as opposed to your family feeling shamed, embarrassed from wanting others to know. a lot of people won't admit that a lot of this of the job's occupation has a lot to do with depression. The example is that when a police officer is hurt on a job and then he's told he can no longer be a police officer and has to leave the job, creates another barrier for him. He becomes secluded. He stays away from the average person that can help him. He's in denial. His career is done. So a lot of guys turn to drugs. A lot of guys turn to the bottle. I mean, that's the reality of it. And the only way that is supported in helping you is your brother officers, because the system does not have, well, let's put it this way. When I was there, there was no system that was helping you to prevent you or to deal with your post-traumatic stress disorder. They would send you to a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and have you talk to them for a few minutes or whatever and relating to your problems. But I think that was like a slap in the face, let me put it that way, from my experiences anyway. I can only really speak on my experiences because, and the reason why I say that is because when they send you to these people for counseling, the question I would have for them is, did you experience what I just experienced? And then how can you tell me how I feel?
Is that a fair question, though?
I think it is for me, because this is the problem. How do you know how I feel if I killed somebody, if you never picked up a gun?
Well, like I said before, I think when you were on, I'm not going to ask you that because I don't even want to know, because that's a hard job that people have to do. And how long were you on the force?
Well, I retired with 30 years.
So how long were you in the service?
Well, 2, and I served 4 years in reserves.
So you were in the service, and then you came out and went. You thought that was going to make you an excellent policeman, right?
What, sir?
Because you had been, yeah.
No, I got drafted.
Oh, okay. Well,
I didn't have a choice. That's one job at that time you didn't have a choice. Well, you had a choice. You could either go to the service or you can go to the stockade.
Or you could go to Canada and, you know. But anyway, you did what you were supposed to do. Now, I think you've mentioned before about your brother. Now, he had to have died a horrible death. He was a police officer too, right?
Yes.
Okay. But before he passed, did you guys kind of get together at any time and just discuss your jobs?
Well, we always did. I mean, my brother was younger than I. But, I mean, you had your pockets of groups of individuals that you worked with, and you had the opportunity to, you know, discuss your situations that day, because everybody's day is different, or the things that you run into, you learn from each other. And the best learning that I've ever gotten teachings from was the elders. I mean, for me, the old-timers are the ones that taught you how to survive. And if anybody knows about Detroit itself, if you can survive in Detroit, you can survive almost anywhere in the country. We were a heck of a training breeding ground. I mean, back in the 70s, we had dealt with the gangs. Back in the 80s, we dealt with drugs. We've dealt with different variations of crime that was out of control. And remember that Mayor Young became mayor in 1974, and the police department was not it was the ratio of blacks to whites were like 10%. So he had to turn around to hire black police officers to come on the job.
Wasn't that back in the time when they were stopping and frisking everybody?
That's, well, the organization you're talking about is STRESS.
Yeah,
that was stress. That was an organization that was developed before he became mayor, and that was one of his campaign promises, was to get rid of STRESS, because they set up themselves as decoys in the streets for stopping the robberies and enforcing safe streets is what it stood for. But it seemed like in any operation, you always have good and bad, and sometimes it's always
true.
The bad that outshines the good.
That's true. That's in any place. You always have. People are good and bad. One person can't be always bad. There is some good in them. And then, you know, there's some bad in the good people. But that's the way it goes. So I'm going to take a break right now, and I'm telling my listeners, if you want to talk to Officer Barnes, all you have to do is press the 1 and ask a question or make a comment, and he will talk to you. We'll be back. This is the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White Show.
Do you know a youth in need of a place to live? Have you always wanted to make a difference in the city of Detroit, but not known how? The answer to both of these questions is Covenant House, Michigan. Covenant House is a youth homeless shelter serving 18 to 24-year-olds in the city of Detroit with education, resources, job preparation, and so much more. If you'd like to learn more about these programs, please call 313-463-2000 or look us up on the web at www.covenanthousemi.org.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Lions Clubs International is a service or membership organization of over 1.7 million members worldwide. It was founded in 1916 in Illinois. Much of the focus of the Lions Club's work as a service club organization is to raise money for worthy causes as first responders. The Lions Club motto is, "We Serve." Local Lions Club programs include sight conservation, hearing and speech conservation, diabetes awareness, youth outreach, international relations, environmental issues, and many other programs. The Lions acronym also stands for Liberty, Intelligence, Our Nation's Safety. For more information, contact us at lionsclubs.org.
We're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White. Okay, and we're back with the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show. Tonight we're speaking with Officer Reggie Barnes. He's been here 2 or 3 times before. We like talking to Officer Barnes. Tonight we're talking about suicide. That's the killer that you never see. We have a caller. Caller? you on the Hello? Line. Hey.
Hello.
Hey.
How are you this evening?
Good. I'm good. How are you?
I am just enjoying Officer Barnes this evening.
I know.
Yeah. It was interesting. During Hurricane Katrina, I remember them mentioning that there were two officers that took their lives during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, on New Orleans Police Force. And this one police officer, I guess it's something like a sergeant or something, I'm not sure, but he was a television spokesman for the department. But they say he had some problems, home problems, then to see his house just devastated and so many other things that he lost hope. And so he drove to one of the church parishes or something, and he just used his gun and killed himself.
I can tell you about that story.
Do you remember?
Well, I not only remember, myself and 12 other guys, we went to Katrina and did a search and rescue mission for 35 days.
Oh, you did?
And that officer was one of the officers that was on a team of ours. That this is a problem that what we saw. They would not let their officers go help their families first to get them out of danger to where that they could come back and help the other persons that were in need of help. I intervened in some way. I may have been out of line, but my thought was real simple here. We're down here to help you, so you have extra help. Why not let the guys that live here take care of their families first, make sure they're on high ground, and then let them come back with sound mind? Because if they're disorientated, if their mind is not focused on the job itself, they can't
right.
help it.
Actually,
that's
I can
true.
See. I can understand that. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So let
yes,
them go get
that.
Their family out. Because I know one guy that I don't know if you remember reading an article about in a nursing home that they did not get the elderly out of there in time, and he kept calling, and then they ended up getting flooded out and dying in that nursing home. He was another one of the officers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I could tell you hundreds of stories when I was down there. It was heart-wrenching. But we came, and the reason why we were down, we relieved 101st Airborne on the cellular towers because they were sniping them, and they needed them back on the ground. So we came in to protect the cell towers, and there was only one or two, maybe three cell towers. And we came in by helicopter and boat because it was like 10 feet to 20 feet of water.
Mm-hmm.
And we came through Baton Rouge.
That was something, yeah. But it was interesting to see. He just lost hope, you know. And then he said that when the officer saw his home devastated.
Right.
You know, he just too much for him, you know. We in America haven't seen a lot of the atrocities that the world has seen. We've been pretty much spoiled here. Even if it's rough for us, we have been spoiled to a great extent. And to see stuff like that, you know, some of the horrors that's coming out now, we're just not used to it. We really aren't. But you're very interesting. Go ahead.
And the way they responded, I mean, there was a lot of lessons to be learned. I mean, we passed yards with school buses, man, that was didn't even move. Where they could have, in the Ninth Ward, I don't know why they couldn't use those school buses to get people out of there. You know, who's checking driver's licenses? If you could just drive the bus and move people, that would have been a great help there. But I don't know. I don't think they prepared for that to happen the way it did. But I remember the engineer that was giving the warnings that the levee was leaking and was possible breaking. I mean, there's a lot of horror stories that we saw down there.
What happened at the Coliseum down there?
Well, the Coliseum, we were actually in the Coliseum, and you talking about horrendous. It was so much going on in that Coliseum. It was unbelievable. I mean, we made so many arrests on predators in that Coliseum, taking advantage of women and children, that we had to make a makeshift holding cells, like, you know, at the Greyhound bus station, they put barbed wire fences up and things like that to house people. It was something that you would not expect to see in America.
We shouldn't have to see it in America that way, but it did, yeah.
Well, we did, yeah.
Yeah.
But we're seeing it now. I mean, aren't we seeing it now with the kids being taken away from their parents?
Right. I think that's criminal too.
Yeah.
Because here in if you left a child alone as a parent, family services will come and actually arrest you for leaving your child unattended. I don't see where the United States of America can separate a child from his parents and not be responsible for that child. I do not understand that one.
Well, you know, there are a lot of things that we're going to be held responsible for.
Accountable for, yeah. Accountable, really. Especially when it comes to children. Accountable for. I remember seeing in the Hurricane Katrina that this one boy, he was saying that what he did was he went in grad, was a student, and he was a young one, like 16 or something. He could drive. I don't know if he had a driver's license, but he took the bus, one of the school buses, and started driving and picking up people.
Rightly so, because, I mean, the problem was, one thing about when that water breaks, it ain't stopping. I can guarantee you that. It's not
stopping.
Look
what's happening now in Houston. Houston has been hit again. All that, you know, with water. It keeps on. I haven't heard that New Orleans was hit with it this time. But you've been very interesting, Officer. I'm going to sit back and listen to you more.
Well, we do have a Houstonian, I guess I can say that, who's listening, and if they would like to make a comment about what's going on now, they can press the 1. But if not, it's okay. Anyway, I appreciate, I'm trying to think of that young man's name that the policeman killed years ago, and they had his name all on the walls. They had painted his name on the wall. I can't remember his name. It was a black, young black guy. Okay, well, it'll come to me. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Officer Barton.
Okay. Yes, Officer Barnes, I had no idea you were down there. So how many of you guys from here went down there?
There were 12 of us. It was a team of us one of my old commanders put us together, and he got all the guys from the strike force that we went down.
So were the guys finally able to go and make sure their families were safe? Were they able to do that at all?
Well, you remember Mayor Nagin was the mayor down there at the time, and he ended up getting indicted late years later. There was a whole lot of corruption down there. It was just some things that were just unbelievable. I mean, that you actually saw with your own eyes. And it's been going on for a long time. A lot of people don't know that up here, we have our issues, but nothing as devastating as what I saw down there. I know that I felt I had a lot of pride to be the officer that I was here, and my goal was to help people, not hurt people. And I just saw a lot of police officers or, you know, situations that weren't warranted. And then the stories I heard from the residents that lived down there and how they treated them. It was just, just eye-awakening. And then to see that the opportunities that we had to have conversations with people while we were helping them, and then they ask us, you know, are you not from around here? So we tell them where we were from. And they have horror stories about us up here. And then they find out that we're just as normal as anybody else when we sat down and broke bread with them in different places. So it was a good experience to share stories with people and then to be able to help people when, you know, devastation came. Because we saw, as the gentleman said, there was people's homes were gone. Actually gone, and we had to assist insurance companies near the end, adjusters, and I was kind of upset with some of those adjusters when they were arguing with the people about their losses. They were asking them, you know, well, you have to show me where your last payment was, or you didn't have this coverage. And I'm looking at that, and I'm saying to myself, these people are in shock. These people are devastated. These people have lost all of their items, their personal items, their belongings. I mean, they have nothing to show. And you question them about, are they covered? And then you say, can you prove it? Well, how am I going to prove something if it's not there? Or you talking about is flood damage and not backup damage or water damage. I mean, I learned so much about insurance companies on devastation. I brought it back here to tell people. There's a difference between sewer backup and flood damage. And if you don't have the right coverage, you better get the right coverage. Even though you say they say we're not in a flood zone, that doesn't matter. Because water can back up from outside in. It's how the water comes into
That's
your house.
True.
If the water didn't come from the sewage, there's one claim. If the water came from outside into your house, that's another type of coverage. So you got to know what you need to protect your home.
That's true. Well, so, you know, a lot of people say a lot of things and do a lot of things that aren't right. So I guess the people that the insurance people are trying to kind of figure it out. But I can understand they don't have any papers or anything. So a lot of them were probably denied.
Well, yes, majority of them were denied. I mean, you know, how do I prove that I paid you my last payment when everything in that state was underwater? How did we know the mail got to where it was going? How do we know the mail got picked up? We don't know.
But, you know, for a lot of things, though, the company should have a record as to whether or not I was insured. So,
oh, it wasn't the fact that they weren't insured. The fact is that if you don't make your payments on time. That's the issue with them.
So they're going to deny you because your payment is late.
Well, you have to look at the fine print, and that's what most of us don't read is the fine print.
Some of us don't read the big print.
Well, then that's another problem. I mean, you know, you can go buy an item at Best Buy, and they give you 6 months to pay with no money down, no finance. But the date that they give you to pay for the first 5 months is the same, but the date on the 6th month is not the same because it's 2 weeks prior to the date that the finance free is done. And if you didn't make that payment 2 months before, then all the finance charges come with that bill at the end of the month. I don't know if you knew that.
Well, there's always a gimmick.
You're right.
I just found out my car insurance has gone up. Anyway, I'm not getting into that situation. But in Richland County, there was a deputy, Derek Fish. He was 28 years old, and he had only been on the job for 6 years, and he committed suicide. And they said he returned his cruiser to the lot, and at the lot, he shot himself with his service revolver.
And be honest with you, that happens more than you realize. There was a general consensus from some research that I did a little while back. I don't know if you understand that being a cop takes about 10 years off your life if you are a street cop. And there's a difference between street cops and desk cops, in my opinion. The street cop that goes out every day to answer that call makes a big difference in you answering a job on the inside. And there's no pun intended on that. It's just that you are part of the avenue of the line of defense to the people that's asking for help. So you are in constant stress mode. You're also in the threat of personal attack. You know, save everyone that you attempted to help. And sometimes you don't get that opportunity to save that person's life. So eventually that takes a toll on you. The difference in inside duty and majority of the outside duty, if you're a street cop, a lot of times back in the day, we had what they called the mad shift. We had to rotate shifts from midnight to afternoons to day every month. So that's a struggle on your lifestyle. If you have a family.
That's a struggle on your sleep.
Well, yeah, sleep deprivation. But the point is on that is as a rookie, especially as a rookie, you get the opportunity to understand the difference between working a day shift, an afternoon shift, and a midnight shift. And sometimes those shifts, when you get seniority, you are able to pick a shift, and what they had back then called married crew, you would be assigned a partner, and you have a third person that's on your crew that would take the place of you when you had your off day. So that those three individuals would always man that one scout car.
Okay.
But now it's changed over the years, and now you just have one shift that you're assigned to. It's either you're assigned to days, afternoons, or midnights. But back in the day, we were assigned what they called MAD, midnights, afternoons, and days, and that's how the rotation was. So that came with struggles. You know, you had difficulties at home because you had to juggle. If you had children, how you going to get them to school? How you going to get them to their games? How you going to get them wherever? And then it developed personal issues because now, you know, you got other problems. Police officers back then also had some issues with finance. We didn't make a lot of money. So that's another reason why a lot of people didn't realize that police officers get strapped. And they end up turning themselves into the bottle or trying to figure it out. Or like you just mentioned about the long hours or the different hours.
So did you know anybody that may have taken a bribe just to get some extra money?
Oh, I know a lot of them that took bribes. I worked on a organization squad called Public and Police Corruption. And so you investigated things like that. So you ran into situations where it's even people you knew were doing things. I mean, you worked with people that you saw doing things. I mean, tell or don't tell. It depends on your situation, on what you thought was right and what you thought was wrong, on how you wanted to handle it, because a lot of times you were on your own if you stepped out there to do what you thought was the right thing. Because another thing would be is that when you see somebody else get burnt for telling on somebody, that kind of like clams
you
up.
Oh, yeah. I know that's right.
I mean, you know, do you want to end up like that person did?
Right.
So,
what you're saying is that maybe that wasn't a suicide, huh?
Huh?
So maybe that wasn't exactly a suicide. If you ratted on someone.
No, I mean, it's been known as that, I don't know if you heard their terminology of friendly fire.
Yes.
Some people can get set up. Some people get caught up in the crossfire. I mean, history tells that those stories. And those
right.
stories are true. Are true. The names are just changed to protect the innocent.
To protect. You sound like a commercial. One question I have for you is, have you ever had any experience with matters that you've spoken about?
I actually have had several different encounters that that kind of like I was involved in the early 70s in two several shootings. One time I was involved in a shooting where that I was on patrol at night on West 7 Mile in Detroit, and I saw a speeding car. I didn't actually see the car. I had a radar unit, and all I could see was the speed, and the speed on the radar unit was over 100. And I didn't see
wow.
the car. It was like a night mist. It was just lightly rain, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. It went by me so fast, I didn't know what it was. I made a U-turn to go after it, and then it was like gone. So I turned on a corner where there was a large building, and then I was just slowly creeping down the street, and then I saw these brake lights come off the building. I drove in the alley. And I confronted this vehicle, and when I jumped out, there was two males that jumped out on me, pulled out the guns, and then engaged. And I shot one, and it hit him, and the bullet went through the other one.
Mm.
And I went through... I don't know if you remember Beverly Hills Cop, that movie with Eddie Murphy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Gil Hill was in the police homicide detective.
Right.
Well, he's the one that came to my scene. And I said, "Boss, I'm in trouble." And he said, "Well, only if you say what you said was not true." Well, I said, "Well, okay." I said, "I only shot one time, but you shot two people." But I only shot one time. Okay, well now you're like, okay, what happens here? So they take your gun, you gotta go to homicide, you gotta write statements, and then you end up going to court after you get cleared from your department of any wrongdoing. Well, of course, when you go to court, you're the bad guy, believe it or not. What ended up happening was, to make a long story short, the two guys that I ended up shooting was coming from a holdup. They held up some people, and I just happened to be, remember I told you, a traffic stop is not routine?
Right.
Well, that was a perfect example of not a routine traffic stop. And unfortunately...
So you were alone?
Yes, I worked alone. And so we went to court. They tried to sue for wrongful altercation and some other charges. They were denied, and I was awarded, believe it or not. The jury awarded me, I think it was like $200,000, but I couldn't collect it.
They awarded you $200,000, which
for
you
pain
couldn't
and
collect.
Suffering. But I
Why
couldn't collect.
You collect it?
Because there was
were...
a law stating that police officers on the line of duty could not receive funds from a civil lawsuit.
Oh,
at that time.
Wow.
Then a couple years later, they changed that law. So
after the fact.
After the fact. So they sent me to counseling. I did not have any problems, I thought. The only problems I had was that I wanted to make sure that the next time I get involved in a shooting, that I understand what I have to go through. So a few years down the road, I got involved in another shooting where a pharmacist shot me. After
a pharmacist?
His son. Yes, a pharmacist shot me. And it was on the news. And I ended up having to take his life. And then I was charged with wrongful death after he shot me. What I was doing was defending myself, even fighting. I was fighting three people trying to protect myself from a traffic stop that I went to arrest. Later, I found out was his son. And then he was the owner of this drugstore that I walked into. And then he came out and started shooting at me for trying to take his son. And so I end up returning fire, and he was dead at the scene. So I got sued for wrongful death, and they took me through, I don't know, these different avenues of painting me as the biggest villain, but nobody would bring out their record, and their record was tainted so much the DEA was involved with them. And I happened to walk in on a operation that I was just in the middle of and got caught up in. And through the grace of God, that's the only reason why I say I'm still here. But they sent me to a psychiatrist again to talk about the issues, talk about the things that would, that might be troubling me, see if I was fit to stay on duty. And what they tried to do was they wanted to end my career. So I had some issues with the persons that I were talking to because, again, like I said, when you deal with a police officer and they encounter an incident like that, you need to be able to relate to that officer where that officer has confidence in the individual that wants to drill you, in my opinion. What I tried to do was, when I was in that position, I tried to develop a team called POST, Police Officer Support Team. And what the purpose of that team was designed to do was to have, within the chaplain corps, a chaplain and an officer that has been involved in those type of incidents respond to those scenes and coach those police officers through that troubled time, in helping them get through that. But there's one area that's always left out. It's the family behind the police officer that does not understand what's going on. And that was the other part of the program, that this POST program was going to help the family get through this process and helping them understand their spouse and the things that he's going through, because there's a lot of police officers I've learned and watched go through alcoholism, go through drugs, go through abuse, go through so many different character changes that end up either destroying their life or eventually destroying their family. And they squashed that whole deal. There's no prevention. Today, there's less than 10% of the U.S. departments that have a homicide prevention program for first responders in this country. They don't want to talk about that. So the question is, who protects the protector?
That's a good question.
And that has always been an issue for me. And then what they did do was they did force me to retire.
Oh, you were forced.
I was forced to retire because I also developed complications from the gunshot wounds that I received because I was shot up again 2 years later.
Oh, wow.
So I was going to trial on that second shooting, and my car, I was bullet riddled car on Jeffries Freeway near Myers, and I flipped my car over and I was shot in the neck.
Oh my gosh!
But again, through the grace of God, I've always put Him as the highest person in my life. That I survived that. But the problem is everybody that was supposed to be in this trial were either scared to appear or any witnesses that were possible that could help resolve this a civil lawsuit just disappeared. So I was the last one to testify, so by the whole process was to try to get rid of me too. So I guess at that point in time they told me my career was done. Well, I did go into some stages of depression because I refused to believe my career was done. So what I did was I found a way to rehabilitate myself over the few years I was separated, and I went to U.S. Marshal's office. And I got hired there. And what bothered me was, if I could work there, why couldn't I go back to where I came from? So I went to several different psychiatrists that the city had, I guess, on payroll or whatever. And then they denied me for whatever reason. And I just kept going to find somebody that would listen to me. So I found a police officer that was a psychiatrist that would evaluate you. And then I eventually got back on. The problem was most psychiatrists said that most police officers try to find a way to get off. They never found a police officer trying to get back on. So they had no program for me. So they had to create a program for me. And at the time, when you have the academy allows you to go through the basics. But this time, the test had to be done with the state. And with us being the largest department, there was no academy class. So I had to go on learning the things that I needed to know and firearms training on my own. And I ended up going to the state, and I ended up qualifying, and I was able to come back, and I did another 10 years.
Wow.
Something they said that wasn't possible. But I didn't believe that I was done. So I had self-preservation, and I believed in God that I figured if I listen to Him, He'll tell me what to do.
All right.
And that's why I feel I got through with that. And then I retired. When I did retire, I retired with a retirement party that I didn't want. with over 550 people at my retirement.
500, and where all these people come from?
They were judges, they were lawyers, they were people that I didn't even imagine would have thought about me. I even had a commanding officer that came and gave me a Warriors tribute.
Well, you were a warrior for sure.
Yeah, I like
yeah.
I said, I tried to do what I thought was right, but I also learned a lot that, and I tried to help other police officers too. When you see a problem, knowing that they're going the wrong way, you need to pull them to a side and try to help them the best way you can. And that's what I tried to do. And that's why I was an Honor Guard member too, because I saw so many different things that we as an average person does not see at a family funeral. You're there 3 days with that family, and you would reach out to that family in the need, because that's when they need your support the most. They lost their loved one through whatever means, and now they just want a grasp on how to get through this. So that's when you find out your role is very important, whether people think it is or not. It's not just for show. It's the internalism that you want to help others survive through. And I think that's the problem with a lot of disasters. People forget that just because you helped them then, it's the aftermath later is when they need the help the most.
Right.
So I tried to do that through all my years of service, and I still get in touch with some of the guys that I know that are disabled or crippled or don't have the means. Because the city, when they went bankrupt, they took our medical. I don't know if you knew that. And that set us back. And then for the officers that had to retire in their 25 years, like a lot of them came on at 21, we're at 46 years of age, under 50. So they have to pay for their medical out of their pocket. So that means that it's either taken out of your pension check, which is not a pension check that is worthy of the person that retired. So they end up having to go back to work because they're not eligible for Medicare or Medicaid.
Right.
And the average cost that we had to pay was somewhere near $1,000 a month because of the type of insurance that we needed. And everybody forgets that we had pre-existing conditions. And when with the insurance market, pre-existing conditions determines on what you're going to pay, because we need specialty insurance because we already have these injuries. Nobody, I don't think, really thought about that. So we had to go to certain specialists, or the specialists that we were going to, we had to pay out-of-pocket expenses. And then there was officers that I know that needed certain medical care that couldn't get it, end up dying, such as my brother and a bunch of my buddies that I know. I had one on top of my head right now that he needed special diabetes medicine, and he was a Marine. And so he ended up having to go back to the VA to try to get it. And then by the time they approved the medicine, he died the next day.
He was dead. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And speaking about military, I don't know if I mentioned, though, but military suicides are the highest reported deaths of veterans. At an average of 20 vets per day are committing suicide. And that includes all the branches of military. Also, what people didn't know, it included the National Guard and the Reserve as well. And
that's a lot of people.
Yes, it
that's
is. And well, and it's just so much just going on that does not address these issues. But we got to remember, everybody that commits suicide has some type of family.
And yeah.
Can you imagine what the families are going through when they lost a loved one to what?
Yeah.
Well, to me, post-traumatic stress disorder is like a cancer. It's a quiet killer, too.
Oh, absolutely it is. But what I wanted to mention, I wanted to mention earlier when you were talking about the vets, September is National Suicide Prevention Month. And they were saying that 6,000 United States military veterans take their lives every year. And that's about 22 every day.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was saying, but I know it's 20.
Yeah,
I have a friend that's a VA nurse, and I don't know if you remember. I think it was early this year. She was on a ward where a young female veteran officer took her life on that floor. She killed herself with a weapon. I don't know how the weapon got in, up there, but she shot herself on the ward floor. And she was her nurse.
Well, all I can say, Officer Barnes, is that whenever you come, you're always welcome, and you always, always give us a good show. You really do. We enjoy having you all the time. And I know my listeners, they get so involved, they don't want to stop you from talking. So that's go ahead.
I appreciate that, and I welcome their questions. So I mean, one thing I've always tried to do was be truthful and honest. I know sometimes it's very hard to do the right thing, but the right thing is the right thing.
Yeah.
Whether you...
Yeah, you're right.
You know, that's all I could ever
well,
do.
Well, you have to remember that what goes around is coming back. It's a coming back. So, I really appreciate you coming.
Well, thank
like
you.
I always do. Always, you always, like I said, give us a good show. And we just enjoy listening to you. And my listeners who called in just to listen to Officer Barnes, I appreciate you as well. And we're going to close. Is there something that you would like to leave with us before we go?
Well, I just hope that in time that society addresses the officer wellness issues, which is also, for me, includes spiritual, mental, social, and physical health, to be the number one priority in helping our first responders get to their glory, their retirement life, and where their family can enjoy what they weren't able to enjoy by them loaning those first responders out to a community that sometimes appreciates them, but most of the time they don't until they need them. I just hope that comes to some truth in the near future.
Well, what I got from some of the things that you were saying is that I know I've always heard that policemen and firemen have the largest divorce rates. And with some of the things you said, I can kind of see how that would happen, because it's hard for men and women in that line of duty. And then it would be hard for their significant others to probably deal with it. So for you being married for 30 years, that's a testament to your wife. Because she hung on in there through all of that.
Yes, she did. She's a blessing in disguise. I mean, I'm not going to say that I'm the the easiest ones to live with. I mean, we all have our issues.
Yes, we do.
But we were able to work them out. And I appreciate her for her stamina. But it's also that it's a give and take situation no matter what, though. I mean, if it was easy, I think anybody could do it. But the testimony is what you believe in the most.
So that's a good thing.
Yes.
And I appreciate you once again. And the last thing that I would like to say to my audience is life is like a piano. What you get out of it depends on how you play it. So with that having been said, I'll say thank you for calling in and listening. Thank you, Officer Barnes, once again, for being here and talking to us. And
thank
I will
you.
Say to everybody, have a good weekend and try to be safe. This is the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White Show. Have a great weekend.